do everything we can to help. Zimmerman mumbled something in German. Otherwise, Cardenas warned, we'll all be sent back to Earth and never allowed to work on nanotechnology again. For a long moment, the old man said nothing. Then, with an enormous groaning sigh, he nodded unhappily. It made his cheeks waddle. Yeah, he said at last. I will speak with your medical staff. I might as well. There's nothing else for me to do now that Kiribati no longer takes our transmissions. Lunar University's courses had been beamed to Kiribati for distribution to students around the world. That had worked well enough for the engineering and humanities curricula. But since most nations forbade teaching nanotechnology openly, the nanotech courses had to be packaged separately and delivered in clandestine ways. Cardenas often complained that she felt as if she were dealing in pornographic videos, shipping them out in plain brown wrappers. When this is over, you can start teaching again, Doug said.
You think we will win?
Zimmerman's tone made it clear that he had no such illusions. We'll try, said Doug, getting to his feet. And we'll do everything we can to help, Cardenas said. Won't we, Willie?
Yeah, without enthusiasm.
Thanks, Doug said. I appreciate whatever you can do. He started off toward the door, threading his way through the equipment standing idle in the shadows of the unlit studio. Behind his retreating back, Cardenas leaned toward Zimmerman and whispered a suggestion to him. The old man frowned, then shrugged.
Maybe we can make you invisible, Zimmerman called after Doug, his voice echoing through the darkened studio.
Doug looked back over his shoulder and suppressed the urge to laugh.
That'd be great, he said,
thinking that bulletproof would be a lot better. Back in his quarters, Doug lit up his wall screen, scanning the computer's personnel files for anyone who had military experience. It was a fruitless search. Moonbase's employees were scientists and engineers, technicians and medical doctors, computer analysts, nurses, construction specialists, agro-technicians, managers, and administrators. They had all been hired through Masterson Corporation's personnel office back Earthside. The only military veterans were a handful among the astronauts who piloted the transfer spacecraft from Earth, and none of them were at Moonbase at the present time. Foray picked his timing very carefully, Doug realized. Halfway through the first phase of building the main plaza, with dozens of extra construction workers on hand and not a single spacecraft at the rocket port. We've even got that dance troupe from Canada visiting. Another 35 mouths to feed. He sat up straight and raised his arms over his head, stretching until he felt his vertebrae pop. Well, he said to himself, at least the dancers don't eat much, I guess. Of all the 2,477 men and women at Moonbase, only one had the slightest military experience. One of the construction technicians working on the new aquaculture tanks, a man named Leroy Gordette. His file showed that he had spent 4 years in the U.S. Army, enlisting when he had been 17, nearly 10 years earlier. His photo on a wall screen showed a serious, almost grim Afro-American with red-rimmed eyes and a military buzz cut almost down to his scalp. He looks fierce enough, thought Doug, staring at the picture. It's better than nothing, Doug muttered. Phone, he called. Call, please, asked the computer's androgynous synthesized voice. Leroy Gordette, he said to the phone system. No response, said the computer a moment later. Do you wish to search for him or leave a message? Leave a message. Recording. Mr. Gordette, this is Douglas Stavanger. Please call me as soon as you can. It's about the military situation we're in. With 20/20 hindsight, Doug could see that this confrontation had been inevitable from the day Foray had won his campaign to be elected Secretary General of the United Nations. He intended to enforce the nanotech treaty with every weapon at his disposal. None of the others, not even Doug's mother, had foreseen that it would come down to military force. But Doug had studied enough history to understand that force was the ultimate tool of political leaders. He had no illusions about it. despite his assurances that this war was not going to be a shooting match. Faure was no military genius, but he was a tyrant. He fully intended to make the UN into a true global government, with himself at its head. Moonbase stood in his way. The nanotech treaty was just an excuse. As long as Moonbase ignored the UN's authority, nations on Earth could justifiably resist UN encroachments on their sovereignty. So Moonbase had to be brought into line, or destroyed. The trouble was, the more Doug studied history, the more he delved into the bloody, murderous track that led to the present day, the more he found himself reluctantly agreeing with Faure's professed aims. 10 billion people on Earth, and that was only the official count. There were probably a billion more at least that the various national censuses missed. 10 or 11 billion mouths to feed, 10 or 11 billion people to house and clothe and educate. Most of them were poor, hungry, ignorant, and their numbers were growing faster than anyone could cope with. 300,000 babies born every day. All the wealth in the world could barely maintain a minimum level of existence for them. The rich refused to help the poor, of course. Not unless the poor reduced their birth rate, lowered their numbers. Starvation swept whole continents. Plagues killed millions. Still, the numbers grew. The poor of the world increased and multiplied and became poorer, hungrier, sicker. Only a world government could hope to deal with the global problem of population. Only a true world government had the faintest chance of redistributing the world's wealth more equitably. That was Faure's proclaimed goal, his aim. Doug agreed that the goal was worthy, vital, crucial to the survival of the human species. He also knew that it would never be achieved, not the way Faure was going about it. The beep of his computer snapped Doug out of his ruminations. Its message light blinked at him. "Answer," he commanded the phone. It was not Gordette returning his call. Doug recognized the face of one of the communications technicians calling from the control center. "Doug, we're getting a transmission from L1. Single frequency. The Secretary General of the United Nations is about to give a speech and they want us to see it." "Okay," he said, sagging back tiredly in his chair. "Pipe it through. Might as well put it on the general system so everybody can see it." "Will do." Then Doug got a better idea. "Wait. Make an announcement that anyone not on essential duty should go straight to the cave. Put Faure on the wall screens there. I want everybody to see this." "Will you be going to the cave too?" "Right," said Doug, pushing himself out of his chair. Touchdown, minus 112 hours. Georges-Henri Faure felt not the slightest twinge of nervousness as he walked slowly to the podium. The General Assembly chamber was hushed, so quiet that Faure could hear his own footsteps on the marble floor, despite the fact that the chamber was completely filled. Every delegate was in his or her proper seat. The media thronged the rear and overflowed into the side aisles, cameras focused on him. The visitors' gallery was packed. He was a dapper little man, shaped rather like a pear, but dressed so elegantly that no one noticed his figure, nor the slight limp that marred his stride. His thinning dark hair was slicked back from his high forehead, and his face was round, pink-cheeked, almost cherubic except for his old-fashioned wire-brush mustache. On the rare occasions when his iron self-control failed and he became agitated, the points of the mustache would quiver noticeably. It sometimes made people laugh, but it was a bad mistake to laugh at Georges Faure. He neither forgot nor forgave. His eyes were small, deep-set, dark, and never still. They constantly darted here and there, watching, weighing, probing, judging. Many said, behind his back, that they were the eyes of an opportunist, a climber, a politician. Faure knew what they said of him, that he was a man consumed by ego and vaulting ambition. But no, he insisted to himself, what drove him was not personal ambition, but an inner desire, a drive, a sacred mission, to save the world